list of the four we're voting.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. Welcome, everyone. We have some public hearings and a work session. Since the good senator from John Day is here, we'll open up Senate Bill 1017 first, and we'll hear that bill, and then we'll do the work session, and then we'll go to the Arundo Domax bills. Okay. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. Beth, would you tell us what this bill is all about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1017 would direct the state forester to establish guidelines for wildfire buffer zones to provide defensible space on lands in the forest land urban interface area. The bill has a dash one amendment that's posted on OLIS and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. Senator, welcome to Environment and Natural Resources.
Senator Dembrough, thank you so much for continuing to work on this bill. Its genesis includes a serious wildfire that devastated almost 50 homes in the John Day area. That Berry Creek fire was a tragedy, and it underscored the need for folks to do what they can do to create defensible space and to reduce fuel loads and to really be cognizant that if they're going to live in the wildfire or wildland urban interface, they really need to take extra precautions. The bill before you came to a point where it was very clear that we needed the technical assistance of the Department of Forestry and other cooperators to make amendment to the bill to clarify authorities, provide some limitations and better structure around the concept, and to move it to a place where I believe that it is ready to go forward. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm in support of the Dash 1 amendments. I think those will provide an opportunity for people to go beyond a 200-foot level area for areas of safety and take advantage of a possibility of some incentive in the form of a tax credit that could either be usable or carried forward for 1 year. And go a little further, except where that would be infeasible because of physical limitations on the property. So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. I think members of the committee are familiar with the bill. I would support the Dash 1 amendments and hope that you will move them into Senate Bill 1017 and move it to the floor with the due pass.
Thank you. Senator, any questions for Senator Perioli? I do have one. So could you just clarify, Senator, what the Dash 1s do from the base bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will just read the talking points that I have been provided. The Dash 1 amendments clarify that guidelines established, and this will be in cooperation with the Department of Forestry, shall at a minimum provide for the thinning of trees within the lesser of 300 feet from residential structures or the buffer zone distance required under minimum standards adopted by the Board of Forestry. Also, it would clarify that the guidelines would only apply to the owner's property, not a neighbor property, not a neighboring property, and do not require management of areas where that would not be feasible. That is to say, if the property runs over a cliff or against a physical barrier. That is the sum total of the changes that Dash 1 amendments would encompass.
Great. And just to follow up, in terms of the tax credit, so the tax credit would be used to allay, to some extent, the expenses of thinning the tree, of removing the vegetation, taking those actions?
Mr. Chairman, in many cases, the biomass created by the thinning are not sufficient to justify a commercial application or a sale to a third party. So in order to provide a little incentive for folks to do what they ought to do, which is to create that defensible space, we've offered a small tax incentive to help them defray the costs of the mechanical harvest or the the labor and the other things associated with creating that defensible space.
Any questions? No, thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to present the Dash Ones and for being able to present this concept to the committee.
Okay, great. So we have some people who've signed up. I'll just go ahead and take them in order. Bill Cluding, Peggy Lynch, and Tim Murphy, please. Okay, well, let's have Roger Beyer. Is Roger here? I'll have Tim come up with Doug at the end.
So Bill says I'm supposed to start. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters, Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is a pleasure to be here today to have a conversation around a really important issue that Senator Farioli has brought before you. I want to first of all express my sympathy and those of League members to his constituents on the Berry Creek Fire. It was horrible. I cannot express more how badly we all feel for what happened to those people. And I want you to know that so Canyon City or Prairie City, either one or the other, has a great quilt shop and a great bakery. So I do know the area about which we're talking. So the League has since 1959 studied the statewide land use planning program. And we believe amongst the elements of that program is protection of our ag and our forest land. We have worked with DLCD and the Department of Forestry to find ways to protect those special lands while dealing with the wildland-urban interface issue. So although we believe in having this conversation, we believe in a couple of things. We believe that county development codes really ought to deal with this issue rather than having a statewide law. They can do that. They do that. In Benton County, for instance, we have a 300-foot buffer requirement from any buildings near those lands. There are some requirements about defensible space, and you get, for those who have property plus forest land property plus a house, the forest land property can get some that the Department of Forestry can assess to protect for fire services. The last thing is that we cannot support tax credits on this. We don't support almost all tax credits, period, but we certainly can't in 2017 with the revenue situation that we have support a tax credit. I would guess that in many cases people can find someone to help them remove some of that those trees and vegetation. But most of all, I'm just thrilled that we're having this conversation because the issue of the wildland-urban interface and forest fires is just a critical discussion that we need to be having, but we need to be having it at local levels. Thank you very much for listening and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Peggy. Bill?
Chair of the Emerald Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial. 1017 is a good bill. It's really, really needed. I think if we look at the federal side of it, almost half the firefighting budgets for the U.S. Forest Service is fighting urban fires. It's trying to save people's homes. And Oregon is almost, our state lands are almost to that point. A good example would be west of Monmouth, halfway to my house. A fire broke out. I seen the smoke. I knew those people were in trouble. Narrow road, brush around their house. When I say a long, narrow road, it is long. And there was two homes involved, but they were on separate roads. And I physically had to block fire trucks from going up the one road, trying to explain to them that there's no way you can get, there's already two trucks on their way in. There's no way to turn around. You're going to get that whole road packed full of trucks. And I said, you need the helicopter. Wisely, Oregon has invested the short call for helicopters. The helicopter was on the way. Within 15 minutes, there was 21 trucks backed up on the highway from Monmouth to Fall City Highway. They would have never, ever got in on that driveway. I jumped in with Fire District 1, took a shortcut through some roads I know, and wound up with these other people's homes. She lost her husband a year ago. I knew she was in there alone. And she just now noticed the smoke. The smoke was coming up the canyon toward her. And I says, Ruth, jump in the rig. Got to get you out of here. What about my dog? I said, put your dog in the back seat. We're going. I got her out of there. But the fire happened to, for some reason, stopped right in her backyard. And she had these overhanging trees. And we discussed that when I got her out in the open. I said, you know, you got to do something with them trees. I urge the committee to adopt this. The Dash 1, that's up to you folks. But we need this bill. The Department of Forestry, I know people have rights around their house, but you not only do you try and save their house, but you're trying to save their life. So I urge the passage, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Bill.
Roger. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'd first like to thank Senator Ferriero and his office for reaching out to us to ask our opinion on this, and we helped him with the drafting of these Dash 1 amendments, which we think is an improvement over the original bill. With that, you know, we can support this. This is a May. It builds on the existing programs that we already have. Going back now 20 years, 1997, legislature passed Senate Bill 360, and which started a program that allows for this. This just builds upon that and maybe makes some improvements. I served on a committee in the interim with the Department of Forestry. It was looking at the different issues, and one of the recommendations out of that committee was that to relook at Senate Bill 360 and find ways to make it work better. I think this may be a good start down that road. With that, we just like to make sure that the improvements of sub 2, section 2 are in whatever version of a bill would pass, and that not allow the or not require the owner of adjacent properties to take action on their properties for a home that's next to a property line boundary. We think it's important that people's private property rights on their own property not be infringed by a neighbor, by requiring a neighbor to do something that's fixed in the Dash 1 amendment. So we think that piece is critical. Also, in that that wouldn't require any additional requirements upon county building codes or state building codes, i.e. setbacks or anything like that for property lines for where the structure could be placed. And we believe that's protected in the Dash 1 also. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Roger. Questions, colleagues? Roger, I do have a question. So Peggy brought up the issue of the tax credit, you know, which is very correct. The appetite for new tax credits this session, I think, is going to be tough. Could you support this bill if it did not have the tax credit component?
Mr. Chair, I think so. It's this can be an expensive proposition for homeowners, thinning around 300 feet, and many times this is not going to be a commercial operation. It's going to be at a cost to the homeowner. And I believe, and we found that in Senate Bill 360, when it was first implemented, there were federal funds to implement the removal of ladder fuels and make a defensible space. Those federal funds are not there anymore. Without the federal funds, without the incentive, it was very difficult. And I think the Forestry Department will speak to that, the fact that there's still a lot of work to be done in that arena. So I think the tax credit would provide the incentive that's going to get people to act. Without that, it's much more difficult.
Thank you. Vice Chair Olson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for mentioning the tax credit. Could you place a value, what would be more important, more significant, a tax credit, or the ability to wipe out the fire before it spreads farther. I would think personally that the tax credit would be beneficial because we could reduce further damage if everybody had their stuff taken care of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, you know, those are trade-offs that I think the legislature is going to have to look at as they're doing their budgeting. I think a tax credit might be cheaper than fighting fire. And if you have dispensable space around homes, I think you'll find it being a lot cheaper to fight the fire versus having to, because that's one thing that the surcharge on forest homes now is there to recognize that it costs more money to fight fires where there's homes in the area. And that's why the legislature went down that road. That's been almost 30 years now that they've been a surcharge on homes in the forest zone because of that. So would the tax credit be cheaper than fighting the fire in the rural interface? It could be. I don't know I can't say I have that data in front of me.
Thank you.
Great. Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roger, your comments made me start thinking about what's happening in this area of the interface. I thought there was something that actually was brought out as to your insurance for your home actually reduced if you actually have that defensible barrier. So I'm wondering if that in itself is not somewhat of an incentive that a homeowner would actually be getting a cheaper rate in their insurance if they actually have established these buffers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I don't know that for a fact if that's in exists. I do know that many counties, maybe all counties, currently for new construction in forest zones, they require defensible space before they will issue a building permit or as part of the building permit. But I think the issue becomes with existing homes that didn't have that requirement when they were built. How do you incentivize those owners to make that defensible space?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brewster.
Kind of response to Senator Pozanski. You're right, but there's many, many people that don't even carry fire insurance in the urban interface. They own their home, but many, many people don't have fire insurance. So it doesn't make a difference.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I believe that is true in the Deschutes County area. They had a special...
I'm trying to remember where I heard that.
Yeah, that in fact they might have done that, but... I just want to make it clear, we're not supportive of having the state forester do this. We are supportive of counties doing this because the state forester doesn't have any money either to set up yet another program.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all three. Let's have Mike Silvaggio come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Silvaggio representing the Sun River Owners Association. I'm going to characterize our position on this bill as concerns that can be addressed. I don't want to say full negative because I very much appreciate what the measure seeks to accomplish. We're very, very attuned to the danger and risk of wildfires. But I just wanted to make it clear, hopefully, that... our concerns don't stem from the impetus of the bill. They stem from the fact that we have certain design standards in the community of Sun River. We have also certain fire mitigation standards. So we have residents already required to remove fuel ladders and tend to their properties. We don't want this to create a situation where it is incentivizing the removal of trees, which might lead in some ecosystems to the advent of something like cheatgrass growing, which might present a additional fire hazard. We don't want the measure here to imply to any residents that they can choose to follow this instead of either locally adopted measures or, in the case of a wild and scenic river, federally adopted standards. So I think it would be much, much comfortable with this measure, especially with the dash ones, if there was either some statement of legislative intent or an amendment that clarified that nothing around what's happening in Section 2 relieves anyone of the responsibility to abide by local, state, and federal standards.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thanks, Mike. Okay, so is Doug Graff here?
I'd rather or, date
yeah.
Grass.
Hey. And Tim Murphy.
That's true.
Whoever wants to go first, the landman or the fireman?
I'll go ahead. Good afternoon, Senators. I'm Tim Murphy, Farm Forest Specialist with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I actually had not seen the Dash 1 amendments before this hearing. Our only concern was limiting the tree removal to property under control by the owner. So with that, I have no further comments.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Doug?
Yes. Good afternoon. Chairman Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as the Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. And here today, you have my written testimony in hand that I sent in today. I'd like to elaborate and highlight a few key components within that testimony. I also want to recognize the department has no position on this bill. I'd like to just further detail and available for any questions on the implementation of the program, the Oregon's Forest Land Urban Interface Fire Protection Program, which was initiated with Senate Bill 360, as elaborated on earlier, highlight some of the administration of the program, how ODF operates to implement this program on the ground, and then wanted to highlight the connection that was detailed earlier regarding the 2016 fire program review recommendations and how this conversation is linked there. So for further orientation on the program, Senate Bill 360 was passed in 1997, established the Wildland Urban Interface Program, which essentially creates defensible space around rural residents, allowing firefighters the space necessary to make a stand against an oncoming fire. Senate Bill 360 standards have been implemented in 17 counties across the state. That's county committees have been established and identified lands that are wildland urban interface and categorized that risk as low, moderate, high, and extreme, and different standards of protection around those homes are established based on that criteria. We have 151,000 parcels within those 17 counties that were identified in the wildland urban interface, and we have 40% of the residents participating in meeting those standards. Senate Bill 1017 before you today augments existing law by providing the tax credit and incentivizing extending that buffer zone beyond existing minimum standards within the law. This concept would create an incentive for landowners to participate in the program. Program administration, from 1997 when we first established the program, we were challenged with implementation, having the ability, the finance, and capacity to implement the program. We received federal funds to help us establish these committees and the coordination necessary on those 17 counties across the state. With Senate Bill 1017's proposal, the annual tax credit would take this program from a five-year certification, which is what we have now, to establish lands to an annual certification, and that would increase our administrative workload to implement this program. The third component I'd like to highlight is the fire program review, and Senator Dembro sat on that committee following the 2013 through 15 fire seasons. We established a comprehensive review of the fire protection program, Oregon's complete and coordinated fire protection system. And the committee ultimately provided a set of recommendations to the state forester, including ODF will conduct an effectiveness review of Senate Bill 360 policies and implementation procedures and determine the most effective pathway forward with a focus on its success in mitigating the risk of wildland fire fuels in the wildland urban interface. We plan to initiate this review in the next biennium. Senate Bill 1017, the conversation today will help inform that effort and that review. This conversation is critically important, and I'd like to thank Senator Ferrioli for carrying this conversation forward and for all those who presented who have an interest in protecting our communities from wildfire. Obviously, a key mission for the Department of Forestry, and we appreciate that engagement. Those are some insights from my report. I would also highlight that the Senate Bill 360 is not the only aspect in which we address the wildland-urban interface and protecting communities. We establish community wildfire protection plans in every county within the state through our cooperators and partners. We have a volunteer FireWise program in which communities engage in fire protection around their communities. And then the cohesive wildfire strategy, which works towards fire-adapted communities. This conversation continues to grow, and I think it's very important. The prevention and suppression of fires is key. What this proposal speaks to is the mitigation on the landscape. We know we average about 1,000 wildfires on the landscape in Oregon annually. The question is, how do we get ahead of this? What can we do in advance? Those fires to minimize the impacts and keep the community safe. And that's what this addresses. With that, I'll take any questions.
Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. I asked Mr. Byer this question. I'll ask you the same. Do you feel, and I know you wouldn't have the statistics in front of you, but do you think it would be cheaper to give a tax credit or fight the wildfire? Or is it more expensive? Should I put it differently?
Yeah.
Is it more expensive to continue to fight the wildfire?
Yeah, that's. I couldn't answer again without the statistics. I will say I anchored into my final statement there with a recognition that mitigation on the landscape is critical. In order for us to really move the dial around getting ahead of the challenges that we have, we know that we have across the West, specifically in Oregon and wildfire, and that's engaging in resilient landscapes.
So just following up on that, Doug, and by the way, let me say, I think I'd be interested when things slow down here and we have a lot, you know, we have time on our hands. I think hearing more about the review, I think would be very useful for this committee.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that.
Absolutely.
So different counties have different requirements. Is that right? Or they work with you to set up requirements? And so are there counties that have required, you know, vegetation thinning or that kind of policy in place already?
Senator Dembro, there is a standard with Senate Bill 360, which is the counties have the ability to establish a countywide committee to determine the low, moderate, and high and extreme risk within the wildland-urban interface. So that's a standard. And once your category is within that category, each parcel says, well, there's the distance, scientifically based on professionals, what we've studied. You need a distance of X if you're in extreme, a distance of Y if you're in moderate for defensible space. And that includes egress and access into the house. How wide is the driveway, removing wood, firewood up against the homes, those types of activities is established depending on that classification. We've applied this program within the 17 most active fire communities, counties. So much of the East and the Southwest is where you see this activity occurring, where the counties are establishing the committees and engaging in this program.
So if a parcel has been deemed to be high risk, or is that the most extreme high risk or hazardous? Or
extreme.
Then the county can require them to take out the vegetation?
So the Senate Bill, Senate Bill 360 established that every 5 years there's a self-certification that the homeowner does that meets a set of standards that's detailed that we deliver to the homeowner around how to create the defensible space. And every 5 years, they recertify with the database, and that's the administration part for the department that will send out the letters, and we get the return slips that, yes, I've certified. Really getting into the weeds on the program, the incentive currently is if a fire starts on your property, You're not willful, malicious, or negligence, and you have established that criteria. Then you're not liable up to $100,000 if you have not of fire cost. If you have not done the certification, then there's a liability of up to $100,000, a limited liability. If a fire starts on your property, and even if you have not gone through the process of certification, so it's using a stick method, if you will, to get engagement, as opposed to this bill looks at incentivizing with tax incentives to get folks engaged in the program.
Great. Yes, Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, could you do you know offhand if the state has ever taken any action against anybody that was part of the program and then didn't keep it up and had a wildfire start and do that? Has the state taken any action on anybody yet?
Senator Bertrager, Chair, we have not. One of the impetus, I believe, for the fire program review's recommendation to study the rules and how we engage after, since 1997, engagement, we have not implemented that. That would be a challenge to implement, and the questions of how do we get engagement throughout the counties were key drivers, because we recognize we need a program that incentivizes activity to make defensible space around our communities. So that was one of the questions folks had. The implementation of that standard would be a challenge for us, and we haven't had that experience to date.
Well, what?
Hold on.
And is it also true that this would only apply to people that applied for the program? So anybody that has never applied for the program, that wouldn't matter?
Senator Bertrager, Chair, the county will classify what's within the wildland or urban interface, and that landscape will be within our district boundaries, protection district boundaries, the Department of Forestry. That gets you into the program. The certification is the part of the landowner, whether they are engaged, are they going to engage or not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. And finally, Doug, with the cost that you're assuming, I mean, right now, the annual cost is $60,000. That's for a five-year review. So would an annual review be five times that, or would there be some economies of scale?
Senator Dembrough, estimated about $60,000 is what we have for administrative cost in processing the communication for every 5 years across those 151,000 parcels, sending out the letters, the response, the database, that component. That wouldn't include the calls that we receive, the local engagement, the field visits from staff. So that's an annual cost. If we were to look at all those parcels annually, then, yeah, you could multiply that five times, an annual cost for administration. But the economies of scale would have to come in at this point as the program grows. Are there better ways for us to have that communication? Can we do something online? We have to get creative to engage and establish some efficiencies in this process if that were to grow.
Great, thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you both very much. Anybody else who wants to speak on this bill? House Bill, Senate Bill 1018, 1017. Yeah. Okay, then I will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1017, and I'm going to open our work session first on Senate Bill 19. Colleagues, this is the one about oxygenates and gasoline, which we heard about, and actually, Beth, why don't you remind us what it is? It's been a long time.
It's been a long time.
And there are some amendments as well.
Correct. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 19 was heard on February 8th. It would update the descriptions and allowed quantities of oxygenates and gasoline sold in Oregon. There's a dash one amendment that would remove butanol from the list of oxygenates not allowed in gasoline. There was testimony from particularly watercraft operators that was a potentially valuable fuel. So that's what the Dash One Amendment does. It has a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
And the Dash Ones?
Simply remove butanol from that list. I'm sorry.
Yes. Butanol. Great. Okay, Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Denver, I move to adopt the Dash One Amendment stated 3-3-2017.
Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the Dash One Amendment stated March 3rd, 2017. Any discussion? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Denver, I move Senate Bill 19 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 19 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, motion passes. Vice Chair Olson would like to carry this. Okay, I'm going to close our work session then on Senate Bill 19. And I'm going to open our work session on Senate Bill 3. Okay. Colleagues, just to remind you, on Monday we adopted the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 3. We have the revenue and fiscal for the Dash 8 amendments, and so I'm prepared to hold a vote on whether or not to send it to the floor. Before I do that, though, I did receive an amendment, a Dash 9 amendment, from Vice Chair Olson a couple hours ago, and I'd just like to give you, Vice Chair, a moment to tell us what it is that you're proposing here.
Sure. Basically, what I said was that I'd like to grandfather all mining claims, both patented and unpatented, that were available prior to any of this legislation.
And so they would be able to mine in the ESH?
Yes.
Yes.
Question.
Senator Roblin.
I promised to ask this question. I tried to figure out if you had an answer. I don't know if he would have one, but that there is in the second part of a deal that I think needs a definition. It has to do with must provide substantial evidence specific to the mining claim in question that establishes the potential violation of regulatory taking. So how do we establish the mining claim is basically what I want to know. If there's a way that we already do that, or how do they establish that? Because they're probably going to have to establish it with the department, the land board, or because that would be the group, DEQ, and/or DEQ, I guess. But I want to know if you knew what it takes to
establish a mining claim.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if it's on federal lands, it's going to have to be established whatever federal agency is in management of those lands. If it's on private lands, then it'll have to go through, I believe, the Department of Geology.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Follow up. And in that particular case, if it's in federal lands, we've got the old federal mining claim act. So they could do a claim post or afterwards?
Yes.
So the idea of what grandfathering.
And so if we want to go specific to dredge mining, it'll be very difficult for somebody to establish another mining claim if they don't have the ability to dredge mine. Not saying they can't.
Right.
Because so the dredge mining just makes it easier to prospect for gold. You have to show that you can get gold or whatever the metal is. And to do that, to have a claim.
Oh, okay. So you'd have to prove the claim to get a claim, at least
so
the potential of a claim.
The cart would be before the horse in that situation.
Okay. So if they have had a claim in the past, is that theirs forever? I mean, do they?
As long as they keep it proofed up.
And proofed up means
they got to be working it.
Okay,
showing that it's still a viable claim.
Okay, that makes some sense to me.
And don't ask me to repeat all the rules. <'cause>
I understand. I understand. I was just trying to figure out what it all meant.
Yeah. So let me just say I respect the intent behind this amendment, as I explained on Monday, as you know, as presenting the Dash 8 amendments, those were a negotiated agreement which allowed us to just focus on the in-stream in the essential salmonid habitat areas. And, you know, what we decided was that we would not allow mining in those streams, but we would allow it everywhere else. And that's kind of at the core of the agreement that was reached. And so that's why I feel more comfortable with the Dash 8. Now, that's not to say that someone who holds a federal claim couldn't bring a suit to argue that they have mining rights, and I wouldn't be surprised if people wouldn't contemplate doing that. Our advice from Legislative Council is that as long as we are making this distinction for the purpose of protecting fish habitat, it will likely withstand that challenge. But of course, you know, the court is the court, and the court will decide. So,
Scott, are we in discussion on what are we in discussion on right
now? Oh, we're not. Yeah, we're actually not in discussion of anything, are we?
Mr. Chair,
yeah, I just had
a question.
Chair?
Yeah.
I'd like to call the question that hasn't been posed, though. I'll just move that we move Senate Bill 3 as amended by the Dash 8 on Monday to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Now we can discussion.
Senator Brzozinski has usurped your prerogative, Vice Chair Olson, but he's made a good motion. And he's moved Senate Bill 3 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. So let's take
now
discussion.
Now is discussion.
Senator Berger.
I will be, you know, very well, very much opposed to this bill because I think there's a lot of social injustice in this bill, okay? So we're saying one group of people can make up their minds on what another group of people have been doing forever. And you're saying, well, you know what, we still don't like what you're doing, take it to court, you might win, you might not. You know, we're giving it. Somebody that has been working a federal mining claim forever, you are taking that away, and that may be generations. And that is simply wrong. So I will be very opposed to this, and I will give a long floor speech on the floor and do whatever I can to stop this legislation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Following the lines of Senator Bartsugger, I've been involved with this from the very beginning. I've been on the committee the entire time. And the interesting thing that was brought forward that still sticks in my mind was the fact that we talk about essential salmonoid habitat. But according to the rules for the miners, they were not ever on the rivers when salmon were in the water spawning. They weren't there. And that was by rule. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife in a letter to me stated that they had no impact. Now, their concern was we had these California miners come up and we got a much larger impact. It's kind of like restricting I-5 to you can't drive in the left lane. We're going to have a lot more traffic in the other two lanes. The point being is that ODFMW said that they did not impact salmonoid habitat because they were not on the water. Therefore, I felt that to be fair to Oregon miners, I would put a grandfather clause in there to allow them to keep doing what they were doing because it impacted them. And when one follows the litany of objections that go down through the line on dredge miners, I think the one that sticks out the most is and the one that would be most annoying to me if they were 6 o'clock in the morning mining outside my house. But that won't happen because I live close enough to a river, but they don't mine that river. The facts are that they were removed from the waters, not predominantly because they're miners, but predominantly because they interfered with other recreational attributes that were there, such as jet skis, float tubes, and everybody else. Typically, they were not on the water even when fly fishermen were on the water, who, in my opinion, impact the waters much more because they're walking on salmon beds when fish are spawning. So that's why I introduced this amendment, so that those people that have been miners all their life in this state still have an opportunity to mine.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I appreciate the conversation, and I have been watching this bill for a long time and been a part of some of the conversations. And for me, the protection had to do with lamprey. I've had a lot of native populations that I work with on a regular basis. Once I understood the life cycle of lamprey, it became evident that they're going to be in the water the same place the suction dredges are. I did hear some comments today that they could make it through a suction dredge. Exciting time for them. But from my perspective, that's still the issue that was really predominant with me. We talked about, because we don't have enough research to say their entire habitat, but it matches very closely to the salmon habitat. So I looked at this bill and the one that with the dash eights to say, actually, we're going to protect this habitat. We're not going to disturb it. And hopefully we can get our lamprey population up. And I do agree with people that say a lot of times any of the fish that tend to spend time in the ocean, ocean conditions maybe are a bigger issue than others. But anything we can do makes it important to me. So I appreciate the dash eights and the work that's been done.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair.
I'm glad you reminded me, because when the ESH was not appropriate, it didn't fit, that's when we added lamprey and bull trout, and then mollusk came in, and I'm surprised we didn't add anything else that walked, looked, or talked like a dog and swam in the water. That's part of the problem that bothered me, is because the science wasn't there, so we added conditions to make it so that it would work. And I feel that the miners have been extremely careful with the environment. We talk about, you know, they'll dig down and they'll dredge out, and mercury will be present, and it could, in fact, disturb mercury. And I will use this in a floor speech, but there's a big bucket over there that's filled with lead, and that's what the fishermen put into the water. And that's just a small portion of it. That's tons and tons and tons of lead. So the fact is that mercury is already prevalent in our rivers. It's already there. And they perhaps eliminate or remove some of it and move it back into the water system, but I think it would be inconsequential. And once again, that's why the nine was there, but I'm glad you brought up the lamprey, because I believe in science, and if science shows that we need to make a change, we should make a change. But when science is used as a convenience to expand, to make sure that our statement is made clear, that's when I go a little bit sideways.
So let me say a couple of things. You know, first of all, the concern here is not only with the presence of salmon, salmon eggs or salmon or larvae in the water. It's with the habitat itself. And I know that we heard from some of the miners that suction dredge mining does not harm the habitat, nor, and in some cases, they would argue that it's good for the habitat. But I really did not see any peer-reviewed studies that upheld that. All of the peer-reviewed studies, you know, and that's not just the opinion of an individual or an individual agency, showed that suction dredge mining can be harmful to fish. And that's what has changed. We've become much more sensitive about the need to protect our fish runs and to preserve fish habitat. And we do a lot of work around that. And I see this bill as being, you know, within that strategy of protecting fish. And as Senator Roblin said, the lamprey, which are also very, very important. And so, you know, it's for that reason that I think it's just safer to not have mining in those areas that have been deemed through a public process to be essential salmonid habitat. And, you know, I will say that, you know, if you look at Senate Bill 3 in its original form, or if you look at the current moratorium maps, they are much more expansive than what we have here. We have really reduced it to the essential, and I believe to the essential of what was intended in the original Senate Bill from 2013, to establish where this practice does harm and where it does not. And everywhere that it does not affect habitat, it's permitted. and permits will be given without limit. Yes, Senator Bertschinger.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're so bent on saving the habitat on these rivers for essential salmonoid habitat and the lamprey, then we need to pass a bill in this building that winter can never come, because winter does far more damage to the habitat than 155 suction dredge miners in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be hard to get the forces to comply with that law, Senator. But
and
really,
if you could,
that would be good.
Yeah, that could be real good.
Yes, Senator Olson will include that in his next invocation in the morning.
That's right.
I mean, I think we have to focus on what we can do as humans, as Oregonians.
That'd be bad.
So, is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none. Shelley, why don't you call the roll?
Senator Bertschinger.
No.
Senator Posansky.
Aye.
Senator Roblin.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Chair Devereaux.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. I'll carry the bill to the floor and in co-carrying with President Courtney.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I give notice of a minority report.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson has given notice. So with that, I will close our work session on Senate Bill 3. And I'll open concurrent public hearings on Senate Bills 789 and 790. And Billy Dunn, you want to come up? Judy?
I got some.
Yes. And as you're coming up, Beth, could you tell us what these bills do?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 789 would require public utilities that grow Rondeau donax and other invasive species for use as biomass to maintain a surety bond on file with the Department of Agriculture. And Senate Bill 790 would direct Oregon State University to conduct a study of Rondeau donax and make recommendations regarding safeguards to prevent or reduce the chance of unintentional migration of the plant.
Okay. Who's going to start? Billy Dunn, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dembrell, committee members, good afternoon, and thank you for this hearing. I am Billy Don Robinson, and I chair the Legislative Committee for the Native Plant Society of Oregon. I was state vice president from 2010 to 2015 and am a current board member. I'd like to introduce our current president, Lisa Blackburn, a U.S. Forest Service retired, but she has injured her shoulder and is just can't make it today, so that's terrible. This is Dr. Judy Sanders, former president of the Native Plant Society of Oregon, professor of communications, Oregon State University. A member of our team got his PhD and can't be here today. He got a job and can't get off work. Dr. Kevin Whitemire is unable to be here today, so he submitted his testimony supporting Senate Bill 789. Since the Native Plant Society started this multi-session effort to alert the legislature to the threats posed to the Oregon taxpayer by the commercial use of Rondeau donax, many individuals and organizations have testified in person or have submitted written testimony. Portland Audubon Society, Nature Conservancy, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, Water Watch Oregon, and others have been very supportive. Numerous academics and experts in this field filed written testimony underlining the dangers and costs if Rondeau donax is planted commercially in Oregon. This testimony is available in the exhibits for House Bill 2183 in the 2015 session. I sent four key documents to members of the committee for your convenience by email, so you would not have to search through the record to find them. These documents are crucial in understanding why Senate Bill 789 and Senate Bill 790 are critical to the future of Oregon agriculture, as well as non-extractive, natural resource-based sectors of Oregon's economy and Native American cultures in Oregon. These four exhibits are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of previously submitted testimony exposing the existential threat to all streamside habitats in the Columbia River system if genetically engineered super invasive strains of Arundodonax are released into creeks or ditches in Oregon. The state of Oregon stands to be held liable for the cost of eradication of escaped Arundodonax, averaging $25,000 per acre, going up as high as $39,000 per acre. This threat is significantly increased by the introduction of genetically engineered or traditionally developed cultivars of Arundodonax. Here are some pictures of Arundodonax gone wild and the devastation it's already caused.
Can y'all hear me okay?
Yes, okay, it's fine.
That's actually just getting recorded and going different places.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So, let's see. You know, you'll see this bridge in later slides, but here's Arundodonax. These are some first-year canes, and you'll see how it layers over. These are the second-year canes. Every cane that layers over has multiple regeneration points. That's the way it grows. So down under that bridge, you'll see this equipment. Kind of gives you an idea how tall this first year growth is. And that's 1 year. Notice how thickly it grows. No other plant grows there. That's what the other way this stuff dominates is it simply crowds out every other plant in the streamside habitat. And of course you have second year growth, you know, and it's layering over as it normally does. This one, you know, you kind of have an idea of the scale. You know, these are workers. And they're trying to save this native tree here. So look at the amazing mass of Arundodonax that they're dealing with and how thick it is. Looks like this one can kind of stand on it. You know, got to get a ladder up there to get to it. And, you know, just talking about how thickly it grows, this is a typical, growth of cane. You know, here's the matter, leaf matter. And it's just nothing else can grow there, period. Once it's established, there's a root mass that is going to be impossible to eradicate. Here's a bridge. The Arundodonax has grown very thickly in the water course. In fact, it invades the stream. It slows the water flow, which raises the temperature, and it actually extincted a native trout in the Santa Ana River Valley already, just due to changes in hydrology and water temperature. But, you know, there's the infrastructure damage, you know, associated with Arundodonax. It washes down to beaches. And, you know, this is in California. And you can see all of the stuff that came down the river and is deposited on the beach and, you know, kicked back up with the wave action. Looks to me like that's Arundodonax growing right there on the beach. Fires. This fire started, it was raining, I think, it was a rainy evening, about 65 degrees, light rain falling, and this stuff, apparently, no one knows for sure, but it looks like it was a homeless camp that set it off. Homeless people, you know, bless their heart, they need some place to stay, and they are drawn to this. But, the dangers that you have from fire and campfires and people just trying to stay warm, you know, that lights it off. This is what it looks like after it burned, okay? This is a burn. You'll notice that the Arundodonax is coming up really well, okay? Essentially why that is, this is a feral population. It hasn't been mowed or harvested or anything. So that incredible root mass that is being generated down in the ground is storing sugars and proteins. And whenever the fire burns out any cover, shade blocking plants, you know, the sunlight gets in there. And that's what it looks like. And it just grows and grows and grows. Here's another example of a burned area. And you'll see the same thick growth of Arundodonax. These are natives. They may come back, but again, You know, it's going to be a lot harder for them. And eventually, the Arundo-Doan Acts will choke them out. This is a feral population of Arundo-Doan Acts in Talent, Oregon. This was identified by Frank Callahan, a fellow of the Native Plant Society of Oregon. And, you know, he took the picture. It's in there with the common teasel, you know, which is another problem. We'll maybe talk about that another day. But, you know, Arundo-Doan Acts has gone all the way from Southern California, where it was planted for erosion control. It's done that damage. As you come up I-5, you'll see it in every little river and creek and ditch. Frank Callahan was telling me, and there's a picture, I didn't include it, you know, just for time's sake, but, you know, there's just a little creek just south of our line, and there's a Arundo-Doan Acts well established on both sides of that creek. It's pushing north. Now, this is on its own. If commercial plantation occurs, thousands of acres, and if it's a genetically enhanced Arundo-Doan Acts, I mean, this is just natural Arundo-Doan Acts. There are, you know, and Dr. Whitmire's testimony, you know, talks about, you know, the planting of Arundo-Doan Acts in Oregon poses a grave threat, a very high likelihood of escaping. You know, it says even the study performed by OSU Extension Center in Hermiston demonstrates the propagation potential and cold hardiness of Arundo-Doan Acts, of Arundo plantings already in Oregon. Even though the executive summary of the study declares that Arundo becoming established inadvertently is quote-unquote unlikely, as Kevin says, facts within the report itself sharply contradict this conclusion. The study identifies multiple types of material by which Arundo can propagate, and critically, the study shows that Arundo can successfully survive the cold winter temperatures in north central Oregon. They have patents pending, at last count, 48 patents pending to make Arundo-Doan Acts cold hardy, drought tolerant, and saline tolerant. It's going to go great on Oregon beaches. You already saw natural stuff taking off in California. So I don't, you know, I just appreciate your time here. You know, I tend to talk a little bit too much about it. I get emotional about it. It scares me. In the testimony, if you take a look at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation research, and you take into account the seven-generation plan that they have in place for cultural survival, if this stuff is growing half a mile wide on either side of the Columbia, as it does in my home state of Texas, half a mile wide on either side of the Rio Grande there at Big Bend Park. Well, what's that going to do to First Peoples? So, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Billy Dunn. Let's hear from Judy, and then we'll have questions.
For the record, Chair Dembro, my name is Judy Sanders. I'm here on behalf of the Native Plant Society. As Billy Don has already indicated, I am employed by Oregon State University. I'm not here in that capacity. And because the second of these bills directs action by Oregon State University, I want to say I'm in the College of Liberal Arts, which has nothing to do with the College of Agricultural Sciences. My background is in social science. And you have my written testimony, so I'm just going to highlight a few items from it. There's overwhelming consensus that Arundo-Doan Acts is a highly invasive plant. It's very destructive in areas where it invades. The consequences of invasion, aside from the immediate destruction of other plants and animals, are great risks in terms of the riparian systems, as Billy Don has mentioned, and, of course, the fire risk. Although I'm a native Oregonian, I lived in Southern California for 30-some years. And during that time period, I saw Arundo invade the Santa Ana River basin in the area where I lived in Yorba Linda, North Orange County, and it also took over a park, and it was terrible. Now, how they solved that problem is there was a huge fire down there called the Freeway Complex Fire, which burned through the Arundo. It was a convenient fire transmission. And then, after it had burned through, they came in with several years of glyphosate. At last data I had on that was they had been spraying it for 7 years and still hadn't completely eradicated it, but they were making very good progress on that. It is difficult to eradicate, and it's very expensive. You could see from the size of the pictures there, it takes a lot of manual labor to eradicate. And in fact, I give you some data in the written testimony about the cost from California, where the cost actually ranged from $4,700 an acre to $64,000 an acre. It depends on the conditions, right? In riparian zones and more thickness, it costs more, and there's more items that you have to protect. And that's the greatest risk, because Arundo is likes to be near water. I think another recent example that I cite is the Salinas River, where a whole consortium of public entities, private environmental groups, and farmers have been attempting to eradicate Arundo donax. There's just under 1,500 acres of Arundo in the Salinas River area. In 2 years, they've managed to clear 12 acres. So they were hoping to have complete eradication of that 1,500 acres in 20 years, but by my calculation, that doesn't seem like that's going to happen. It's enormously problematic. And then, of course, there's the cost of eradication, which the people of the state of Oregon should not have to pay. I don't know. I grew up in a home that said, if you made a mess, you should be responsible for cleaning up that mess. And I bet that most of you grew up in that kind of a home, too. And the bond measure asks to make sure the people who make the mess are responsible for cleanup of the mess. If there's no mess, then it's not much of an issue. But we certainly don't want to put that on the taxpayers of Oregon. Obviously, we're not in a financial position to afford millions of dollars on Arundo cleanup anyway. In reference to the study bill, the goal here is to create something that would be on order of a peer-reviewed kind of study, an academic meta-analysis of research on this, and something that takes into account what other studies have not, which is the current research that's been done on patented and patent-pending Arundo donax, so that we consider the full course of the literature. And by an entity not funded by a utility or other involved stakeholder. I want to mention one other thing. I expect you're going to hear from PGE that they're abandoning the Arundo project, but they're not the only player in town. And in fact, I think they're not the greatest risk. The greatest risk is that some player in southern Oregon wants to grow Arundo, where it has already escaped and established feral populations, and that would be even more significant. So the bill isn't directed directly at PGE. It's directed at entities that want to grow this for biofuel. Could happen anywhere in the state, and we think that they should be responsible for the financial consequences of it. And with that, I'm open for questions if you have any.
Yes, Senator Roper.
So other than biofuels, is that the only use of Arundo donax? Are there other uses of this particular product worldwide?
Chair Dambrow, Senator Roebling, yes, there are. There are a number of patents pending, and in my written testimony, I reference those. Currently, they're proposing using it. They'll just take the canes, and they'll put them in a mat, and they'll put binder with that, and they'll pressurize that, and then that will come will turn into a laminated building product. Okay, so that's one use. That's there's a patent pending for that. There's another one. It's called Nile Fiber. It's Arundo donax, but they call it Nile Fiber. You know, it's a patented name, and they like that for paper. This is a natural cultivar. They were taking a look at stands of Arundo donax, and they found one that happened to be, it had a bigger purple ring around it, and the walls were thicker, and you know, so they nurtured it, and now it's a cultivar. It grows 25 feet in a year. You know, it's just And the thing they really like about it is it's so easy to propagate. You know, it just really takes off. You know, you can have one propagule and, like, you know, it just goes crazy. So there's the fiber for it, for pulp, for laminated building material with that process I mentioned. Dr. Whitemeyer mentions that they're trying to find one, develop a cultivar for livestock fuel, food. You know, feed it to the milk cow, you know. So between, Dr. Sanders mentions reeds, you know, for instruments, musical instruments. You know, that's very small scale, and we're not concerned about that, you know. Gosh, I'm a music lover, you know. Want to make sure the marching band sounds good in the symphonies and stuff. But you know, those are some of the uses.
Follow up. So, it's natural habitat, and how do they control it in those places? Is it nature that controls it, or does it just take over large swaths of area in its native habitat?
Yes, there's some debate as to where it came from. It's been, but everywhere it's been planted and released, it is, well, like in California. I mean, it marched the entire distance of the state, and you'd be hard pressed to find a ditch. Well, I was talking to a buddy. He said, "Yeah, they were out having some beers. There was this little ditch, kind of creek that went through." He said he did a double take. It was full of Arundo Donax, right there in town. So you know, it always escapes.
But we don't know where it actually originated.
South Asia, I think.
Yeah, okay, we think probably in India. They have developed some biocontrol measures that are being used in Texas. There's a wasp and a scale that are being used. Neither of those would survive in Oregon because they're both warm climate items. And they've had some success with it. It's not magic. But I think over a two-year period, they reduced the biomass in areas where they had thickly released both of these by about 30%. That's not eradication, but it's knocking
control,
it back.
A little bit of control. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted
a question for your fellow Texans.
Well, I was going to say it's always nice sitting here to listen to someone with two first names. You know, Billy Don.
Yes, sir.
Frank,
thank you.
You know. So what part of the great state of Texas do you come from?
Well, me and my daddy both, Big Billy Don,
yep.
Of course.
I'm a junior. That's why I'm Floyd Frank.
Exactly. We were both born in Abilene, but daddy was a doodle bugger, you know, a seismograph, you know, looking for oil, and went over to northeast Texas where a new defense plant, a steel mill, was opening up. So he settled there and you know, worked there, and I worked there in the summers to get through school, you know, at University of Texas, Austin, so.
That's where we differ.
As an Aggie.
But I was born in Lubbock, raised in San Antonio.
My grandmother used to discipline me in Lubbock if I was acting up. She'd give me a broom and tell me to go out and sweep the sidewalk, get all the sand off the sidewalk. Well, you sweep one end of the sidewalk, and you turn around, and man, that other end of the sidewalk was full of sand. The wind blows.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Billy Don. You know, recent cold snap did a number on the arborvita in my backyard that separate our house from our neighbors.
This would work.
And I had been thinking about Arundo Donax as a fast-growing alternative, but I think maybe I won't go there.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
We think that would be a great idea.
Thank you. We appreciate it. I do have a question before we bring up our friends from PGE. Who, you know, I think will tell us they're not going forward with the biofuel. But the bill 789 does specify a utility, and so if the interest were in preventing other commercial uses of Arundo Donax, probably an amendment would be of interest. Is that right?
Yes.
Senator, yes, please. I was reading that, you know, I was thinking, as I understand it, amendments don't happen on the floor. They happen in committee. So an amendment to that effect would be most welcome. I would appreciate that.
I'm pleased to hear you read my last newsletter, Billy Dunn. Great.
I look forward to those. I'm getting to be kind of a legislative nerd.
Thank you. Well, thank you both
thank you.
For
thank
coming
you.
To testify and for presenting these bills to us. So I'll call up Brenda McCarthy now. Brendan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I need to testify any longer. members of the committee, and Chair Dembrough, Brendan McCarthy representing Portland General Electric. It's been a long time. Good to see many familiar faces again. I don't think I need to explain who PG is. I think we're all good on that matter. So about 2009, we began looking at closing Boardman coal-fired plant. And at that same time, we began thinking about how it's sort of a relatively new coal plant, and is there a way we could reuse it in a sustainable way, keep people employed? And one of the things we turned on was maybe we could take biomass and torrefy it and turn it into biocoal and run the plant. Good idea. And just recently, after many years of effort, we actually ran the plant for several hours on 100% torrefied biomass. We're very proud of that. It was longer in coming than we thought. We originally thought we'd be burning that in 2012. So 5 years late isn't too bad, but we got it done. We proved the proof of concept out. You can take cellulosic material and roast it until it gets crispy and pulverize it in a coal plant, it's even a large one at 585 megawatts, and make it run. I don't diminish that effort by any stretch of the imagination. I think that it has implications for other coal-fired owners elsewhere in the world, but for us, probably not. The Arundo was grown as part of that project. At maximum, I think we had 94 acres. We're down to about 30 at the moment, and we plan to eradicate that last 30 coming this growing season, or starting this growing season. As previous people testified, it probably will take a little bit to eradicate it. We'll be monitoring that for several years post-eradication to ensure that we don't get any regrowth. We have already had experience in eradicating it out of the 64 or so of balance, and have not had any major concerns. We have had to go back to address it, but we have been working on it, and it shows signs of being eradicated. So we can do that. You know, fundamentally, I think that I want to leave the committee, and I know you have my letter. This was an R&D project. We learned valuable things about turning a coal plant into a biomass plant. We learned valuable things about growing Arundo in Oregon. I have nothing, and my company has nothing against these bills in particular. We don't believe that they're necessary and that we're moving out of it. But that's, of course, not my decision to make. It's this committee and this body's. So with that, I think I can answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Brendan. Questions? I do have a question, just it's not exactly related to the Arundo, but so what was it that made you decide not to go forward with the biofuel?
Sure. Well, I'll answer with the Arundo first. Initially, when we looked at Arundo, we looked at it for a variety of reasons, but mostly for the same reasons that Billy Don and the Native Plant Society don't like it. Look at it, and it grows really well. If you're going to perform a biomass conversion, you need something that's going to grow robustly close to the plant that you're burning it at. And that reduces your transportation costs and lowers your growing costs. We had experience seeing Washington State growing it in Prosser, which is really just across the river from Boardman. They had some good luck with it. We expected somewhere between 12 and 25 tons per acre. We never really got that. I think at most we got about 9. And ultimately, running a biomass facility on that size, or any size really, it comes down to cost. How much does your fuel cost you? And including, you know, growing it and transporting it. And that's just it's just the facts of life. We did most of the material for the test burn came with a great partnership with Oregon Torrefaction. We used sustainably harvested beetle kill lumber that was taken off of National Forest pursuant to stewardship contracting operations. That's a great partnership with them. You know, ultimately, there's not enough forest material to burn 300 tons an hour at a coal plant. So it really, Senator, it really came down to cost. And when we price it out per ton, it's about, right now, it's about 2.5 times where it needs to be in order to make that a profitable venture. So, you know, it's unfortunately, the R&D project took us a little longer, and perhaps if we had more time between now and ceasing coal burning operations, we could work on improving that supply chain. But right now, it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously, Arundo Donax is a problem because of its propagation tendency. But, I mean, are there any vegetation out there that, you know, that grows really fast but doesn't tend to spread that way?
Well, Senator Dembro and members of the committee, you know, we did look at a sorghum, a non-sweet sorghum that promised in the 12-ton per acre range. That, too, didn't quite bear that out, and that was part of our test. It is tricky. Things that grow really well may very well be invasive. And, you know, we'd love to, you know, part of our R&D project, we did actually test torrefy a number of invasives in Oregon. And the good news is they all work. You can torrefy English ivy. You can torrefy Scotch broom. You can torrefy juniper. They all work. The question is collection of it and the costs in that collection. So, you know, there probably are other materials, but as I said in my letter, there were some that we discounted out of hand because we felt as though it was too much like playing with fire. Miscanthus was one that comes to mind. But as we looked at Arundo, the other elements of it we felt as though were manageable, mostly around keeping it away from water, and mostly if you're growing it in Oregon, in eastern Oregon, you're keeping it away from at least natural abundant and non-abundant rainfall. In the area where we're growing it, they get about 8 inches per year. So we felt as though that was somewhat of a natural barrier. Keeping it away from the waterways there was the other one. So, you know, the how the roots grow, whether it sets a seed or not, whether, you know, all those things were important when we looked at things. And this was one that we clearly recognized the risk. It wasn't that we didn't go in with eyes closed, not understanding it. But the ones that we saw, we felt as though were manageable.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Oh, the terrification process, is that was that expensive as well? That add to the shipping and all those other kinds of stuff? Because that, it just seems that has to be somewhat energy intensive as well.
Chair Dembro and Senator Roblin, the torrefaction process itself does require energy input, and that energy input can come from the material itself once it's going. It usually requires some natural gas or something like that to start it firing. It is an exothermic reaction. It does create its own heat, and it does create its own volatiles that come off. So you can fire it from that. The torrefiers that we are using in this test burn, or I should say that Oregon Torrefaction was using, were not set up that way. They were just more like a wood chip dryer or another burner, if you know the nature of an R&D process. We did engage with an entity from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to build us a torrefier. We built it. It ran. We had a small explosion at that, which was the thing that caused us to ultimately shut that part of the R&D project down. So we, you know, again, this was a very much an R&D project. We learned a lot. We had some notable hiccups in the process. But I'm not sure. I think I answered your question.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you. You piqued my interest when you talked about juniper, since it is such a big problem in our state. Would there be enough quantity of juniper for you to look at? Or is the hauling of it the mitigating factor?
Senator Dembro and Senator Olson, it's the dispersed nature of it. You know, there are there's a lot of juniper out there, and the mitigation efforts on that is to cut it and lay it. If we could get a truck into every place that they were cutting and laying it, you know, maybe there would be some possibility. But again, I don't offhand remember the quantity numbers. There's a lot. But at the same time, 300 tons per hour of torrefied material means, you know, you need about 600 tons of green material, actually probably a little bit more than that. And it's just, it's a large sum. That's why we looked at the sort of more of the of an agricultural style crop.
Senator Brzezinski.
Got to ask the question. Industrial hemp.
Senator Dembro, Senator Brzezinski, you know, I was down at the cafe earlier, and Ivan Malisky asked me the same question. We probably could torrify it. If anything contains a significant amount of cellulosic material, it can probably torrify. And it's not beyond the possibility. At this point in time, we're looking at an end of 2020 cease burning coal operation. We'd have to re-permit the plant, get new air permits on it, get a new, probably a site certificate amendment or maybe a wholly new site certificate. We'd have to put it into our integrated resource planning process, and it would have to come out as a least cost, least risk resource. And, in 4 years in utility time is like a blink, as you're well aware. So I think we've pushed this at this point in time as far as we think we've pushed it, and we're really pleased with what we've done. But at this point in time, I think it's probably we're just going to have to sit on our learnings at this point.
Okay, thank you very much, Brandon.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Anyone else here who wanted to speak to these bills? Okay, seeing not, I'm going to close our public hearings on Senate Bills 789 and 790. And colleagues, I guess we come back tomorrow, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes.
You like to keep us going.
Okay, so, but for today, we are adjourned. We're adjourned. For today,